For the first time, I glimpse how we could do this. Not just tonight, but from now on. Together, side by side, we're like a Damian warship. Buoyant, impenetrable, precise. This is our story, and tonight we will own it. And to my own surprise as much as anyone's, I'm making jokes. I am aware of eyes on us, not just within the group where we stand, but from around the room. Everyone, every adult, is watching us from the corner of their eye. I've been smiling so much my jaw is beginning to ache, but I'm surprised by how good it feels to lift my chin and acknowledge the truth. Not just the truth of our history, but the truth of who I know Lee to be. Like stripping naked leaves me nothing left to fear. Lee's knuckles, whitening as they clench the stem of his wine glass, are the only indicator of strain. Finally, when they are bone white, he turns to me. His smile goes limp like a puppet released from its strings.
I need a few minutes. I'll be in the washroom.
I'll wait. As he walks away, a woman with peppered black hair touches my arm as if she knows me, and I turn to her with foreboding, because by now I've come to dread her kind of conspiratorial smile. But what she says takes me by surprise.
It's such a pleasure to finally meet you, darling. Parry has said such nice things.
Parry, I repeat, racking my memory for an acquaintance of such a name, and the woman smiles, her heart-shaped face brightening as she catches sight of someone behind me.
Oh, there you are, darling. Weren't you going to introduce us?
I turn. The woman is smiling at Power. He looks between us like a taste is curdling in his mouth. I feel a smile, a real one, split my face for the first time tonight.
Hello, Parry.
I had known Power was adopted, but rather than any difference in visage, what strikes me is how open his mother's smile is in contrast to his, and how loving. I had somehow imagined Power's whole family must be as prickly as he is. Power scowls.
May I borrow her, mother? Urgent. Affair of state.
Mrs. Hesperides nods, her eyes twinkling, and I allow a scowling Power to lead me by the elbow to a shadowy corner. He lifts two fluted glasses of wine from a server's tray as we go.
You know, I quite like her, I tell him when we've claimed an alcove as our own.
Power lifts a finger in warning. I struggle not to laugh.
Do not ever, he says, call me Parry again.
He offers me one of the glasses of wine, his gaze flicking lightning fast down my dress, then up again, squinting in the dim light of the alcove. His eyes narrow on my smile.
Are you enjoying being paraded around like a dragon lord's pet?
I choke on the wine I've tilted to my lips. Lower the glass. The smile is sliding off my face. Power stands tensed, half smirking, but wary, like a dog that has bitten, awaiting a kick. The wine from my glass splattered on his face. A backhand across it. I do neither. Just look at him and wait. And as I gambled he would, Power wilts. I feel a strange, cool triumph at the sight.
It was a joke, he says.
I want you to stop making it. Power lowers his glass.
To me or to Rock, I want you to stop. No more surf jokes.
Power lifts his eyes to the ceiling, and then he says, like we're in some sort of negotiation,
All right, but I reserve the right with Lee.
I can't help smiling, because if this is a negotiation,
then I just won. Even though it isn't an apology, it's more than I once could have imagined Power offering in 100 years. Even if Lee doesn't make the cut. Why do you hate him so much? I ask. Power twitches, his mouth twisting on the rim of his glass. My reasons for disliking charismatic dragonborn assholes are my own. He waves an arm to the mingling golds in the center of the floor, the wings of the Fourth Order glinting on the shoulder of his uniform. Even if I stop making surf jokes, do you think they'll stop thinking of it? Look around you, Antigone. Everyone in this room sees you, sees him, and thinks a storm scourge with his surf isn't that traditional. I can hear my pulse in my ears, a familiar pounding. I know this moment. This is the point when I curl back into myself. When I start to look around the room and wonder what these golds are thinking. Looking at Lee and me, and instead of the jokes I dare to make, I imagine the tawdry history of feudal violence repeated that they see, and see it too. But then I shake my head, clearing it. Not tonight. Tonight, I'm full of confidence, like a dragon riding a gale. I am done letting these tendrils of shame tie me to the ground. No shadow is so great that it doesn't shrink when viewed from the air. They can see what they want. Power pauses, his glass to his lips. Then he lifts it, toasting me. We drink together. Lee rejoins us, white-faced. He doesn't seem to notice Power. Lotus's dad just asked to interview me about Palace Day. In the washroom. He... What? Power pushes a wine glass into Lee's hand. Lee takes it, unseeing, and downs it. Yeah, he... Apparently, he's writing an epic about the revolution. It's a commission from the Ministry of Propaganda. He told me he thought my account would help paint the full picture. Lee's speech is pressured, a note of humor bordering hysteria straining through, and he lets out a wild half-laugh. Sausage? A server leans through our group, offering a plate of small foods. For a moment, I don't believe what I'm seeing. Bacon. Sausage. But whether or not my eyes believe it, my body smells something good. My stomach, which has been clenched on iron-size rations, growls audibly. Don't mind if I do, Power says, taking two. Lee's and my eyes meet. Neither of us moves. The server moves on. You might as well, Power says through a mouthful of sausage. Enjoy yourself. Perks of testing well. Perks. All at once, the buoyancy I was feeling falters like a punctured wing losing altitude. This is what it means to climb. Bacon and sausage while the rest of the city is counting ration cards. And this is the appetizer, which only leaves me to wonder about the main. How can the golds feast at a time like this? It's the kind of thing that makes me want to go back to the palace and file a complaint of misconduct, except I'm pretty sure that the people to whom I would submit that report are in this room. Power's eyes are on the far side of the room, where Kor sits, ensconced alone in his shadowy booth like a fortress. Do you think Kor's going to smuggle something home to his idiot sister? Lee rounds on Power, fists bawling. I seize the back of his uniform. After this many years of handling boys who think they are handling Power, it feels like a reenactment. Not here. Am I interrupting something? Miranda Hayne, The Minister of Propaganda has found us and is smiling with the edge of a teacher sensing trouble. She has, since tea with the Protector 3 hours ago, knotted her hair in an elegant bun and changed into a shimmering gown that glows on her warm brown skin. She points to Kaur's booth, where he's been joined by a young woman. I'd like you all to have a brief group interview with one of my interns from the Gold Gazette before Atreus arrives. Do you mind? Hane's intern is around our age. She looks unsettlingly familiar and has the same olive complexion and wavy hair as Kaur, with whom she's laughing as we approach. She has not taken off her coat, as if she just came in from outside and intends to leave without delay. It seems afraid. I extend a hand as I take a seat in the booth opposite her. My name's Antigone. The girl smiles at me and does not shake it. Did you know we were actually in the same Dragon Tongue course last term? You must not have noticed me. With all your patrician friends, I'm Megara Roper. I can feel a blush spreading. The way Megara describes the course we shared, I sound like a classist snob. But the patrician friends I made in that class were the first I'd ever had. Shame that class ended so abruptly, Megara goes on. She blinks very little, and her eyes are bright green. Wasn't it mysterious how our professor just disappeared, Antigone? Lee twirls the stem of his glass between thumb and forefinger. Richard Tyndale disappeared because I reported him. The official charge was sedition, to protect Lee. But the real reason was that he was soliciting Lee on behalf of the Triarchy. Does Megara guess I filed that report? You a big fan of Dragon Tongue poetry? Power asks. Megara folds her arms. No. Tyndale was my scholarship advisor. I didn't know Tyndale would be the sort to advise lowborn students. Power clears his throat in a way that disguises a snort, but my conscience prickles for the first time since charging Tyndale with sedition.
Advisor or no, he was a terrible teacher. Kaur mutters.
Megara rolls round to glare at him, and he lifts his palms. Like this is an argument they've had many times before. At my look of confusion, she flicks a thumb between herself and Kaur and explains. Same grammar school. She rakes dark hair back from her face, produces a notebook, and clears her throat. Her urban accent trims itself seamlessly into palace standard. Shall we do it, then? I have an invitation from Minister Hane to justify. A server pauses at our table to offer refills of sparkling wine. The boys take more. Megara and I decline, and our eyes meet briefly as the server walks away. Am I mistaking a challenge in her gaze? You're some of the smartest young people in the country, she begins, and I can't shake the impression she recites this with a certain amount of irony. And I'm told your training gives you unmatched insight into the operations of our government. Tell me a little about what you all see as Kallipolis's biggest challenges at the moment.
The rationing program, Kaur says at once.
Megara's nodding as she scribbles. What about it?
Some might say it's unfair.
Megara tips a pen in Kaur's direction. Indeed. So you would agree with the Gold Advisory Council that those who say it's unfair are a danger to civil order? Kaur blinks. Power jumps in, knocking back another gulp of wine.
Absolutely. Those protesters. The Passy? Southside's daughter? They're a threat. They must be silenced.
Kaur scoffs.
Threat? They want justice.
After watching Cheapsiders on the verge of breaking into a shopfront in a public square in the name of justice, I have very little patience for this interpretation.
You mean by looting bakeries? Because that's what I saw Southside's daughter inciting in Cheapside.
Cor blinks. Megara watches our interchange with fingers tracing her chin, her eyes narrowed.
So you would agree with Cor? She asks me. That the Passy and Southside's daughter are our greatest threat at the moment?
I laugh out loud.
Our greatest threat is the one from New Pythos.
Megara's pen pauses on her notebook. I have the sense that I didn't give her the answer she wanted.
Spoken like a true fleet commander, she says, looking up. Which happens to be a new title for you. How has that transition been?
Fine. But she's looking between Lee and me now, leaning forward.
What about you, Lee? What would you say about Annie's take on the threat from New Pythos? Is the war threat difficult for you?
Lee levels his gaze at Megara. Why would it be difficult for me? Megara lets out a soft laugh. Lee lifts a shoulder, sips from his wine, and adds,
It isn't my place to judge Antigone's opinions. She's my commander.
Something warm and proud blooms in my chest. Our eyes meet, and he lifts his glass fractionally, like he's toasting me. We'll do this together. I lift my glass to him in return. Megara looks between us, and then at the 6 inches between on the bench. She tilts her head, black hair tossing.
But is that all she is to you?
Lee blinks.
I'm sorry.
The city is dying to know. The Golds are dying to know. You may have taken vows forswearing marriage or family, but that doesn't quite cover everything. Is there more between you? Everyone hopes there is. After all, wouldn't it be only natural?
A moment of thick silence follows her words. Cor has choked on his wine. Lee has gone quite still. Even in the candlelight, I can see him reddening. And for all I told Power moments ago, that I didn't care, I can feel heat ignite in my face. To my surprise, Power speaks first.
Piss off, Roper.
Megara swings an arm out, holding Cor in as he rounds on Power and turns her smile in a new direction.
Power, Sir Eater. Your reputation with women precedes you.
Power sneers.
Not with any of your friends, I can assure you. I don't bother with the dregs.
Cor lifts an arm and points.
The First Protector's here.
Across the room, Atreus Athanatos has entered the room to a ripple of greetings and well wishes, dressed in a well-cut but unadorned black tunic. Lee's eyes narrow on him like a target. My stomach has skipped for other reasons. Not 3 hours ago, that man poured me tea and complimented my performance as a guardian. And now, when his gaze travels around the room, he looks in the direction of our booth and, I'm almost certain I didn't imagine it, nods at me. I resist the urge to nod back. Dora announces him to the room.
Citizens of the Lyceum, she says, I would like to thank you all for coming to this fete of the Fourth Order, the first of many opportunities, I hope, for us to get to know these four special young people a little better. Now that the Protector has arrived, I hoped he would start us off with a toast. Protector?
Atreus lifts his glass.
Join me in toasting the accomplishments of our finest four guardians.
whose illustrious careers have only just begun. May their light continue to shine, long past my own, as a beacon to the people of Kallipolis.
We drink. Lee has gotten to his feet. Even in the candlelight, he looks pale.
I'd like to propose a toast to the first protector in return, he tells the room.
Golds turn to look at him, surprised at his nerve. Kor and Power are fixated on him. Megara Roper has slid away into the crowd, and Atreus has frozen, lips parted, like prey that spots a predator. Lee, still smiling, has a fury burning behind his eyes that sets my nerves on end. I have a sudden vision of Lee on a precipice about to jump. I just can't tell whether he's about to take flight or plummet. He lifts his glass.
To Atreus, who spared my life as a child because he was merciful, who has been like a father to me for all the years since I renounced my own, who saw in me not a dragon lord, but another revolution's son.
My nerves still with the same satisfaction that comes with watching Lee execute a perfect contact charge. Back in the saddle. We drink. Atreus's lip twisted. He bows deeply.
I thank you for these gracious words, Lee.
To Lee Ser Pellor, someone cries.
The room resounds with it as glasses lift a third time.
To Lee Ser Pellor, the revolution's son.
Lee's smile, full of ice, fills with triumph as he holds the first protector's gaze and bows. And then the sound of shattering comes from the floor below, and a scream rends the air.
10. Southside's Daughter. Lee. This night feels like one long waking. As if I've been asleep, not knowing it, and waking by stages. Because for all I've thought over the years of the ways patrician life is indistinguishable between this regime and the old, the reality of what that means is not driven home until the moment when a server offers me sausage wrapped in bacon during a rationing crisis. And then, with the presence of Atreus, the man who I thought saved me but, in fact, betrayed me, the meaning of Annie's words becomes clear. Be the one who replaces him. I have spent a lifetime overgrowing thoughts of revenge, of turning away from that path because the wrongs outweighed the rights. But there is a blessed irony and satisfaction in realizing revenge is something I can feel justified in wanting after all. In realizing that this regime, which so casually sells my family's things and displays them in dusty corridors with little plaques to remember us by, deserves all the retribution I used to long for. Never mind that Atreus betrayed me and wants me dead. His regime is failing, just as the last did. Feasting during a famine, warm inside while outside the city hungers. He deserves to fall. And revenge doesn't need to take the form I pictured as a child. Atreus's life isn't what he values. He values power, popularity, and control. Revenge doesn't need to begin with a knife. It can begin with a well-delivered speech. And after that, the moment that most marks the crossing from sleep to waking, like cold water thrown when I realize I have not so much woken from a nightmare as to one, is when I hear that scream. Because then, memory becomes premonition. The golds around the room have frozen, silence has fallen. The sound of something heavy breaking on the floor below shocks the polished floorboards at our feet. Another shout. Another scream. Annie, Power, Cor, and I are on our feet. I take two steps sideways, crack the blackout curtain, look out onto the main courtyard of the Lyceum. In the moonlight, reflected by low clouds, I make out a trickle of figures moving across the dark lawn from the porter's lodge to the storeroom adjacent to the classroom building that has been converted, since the food shortage, into a public granary. They're raiding it. Which means the guardhouse at the porter's lodge has been disabled. The Lyceum walls have been breached, and another scream from below, a thunk. Directly below the window, servants begin to pour from the entrance to the club's kitchen, fleeing with screams. Objects are being thrown, bouncing and rolling across the darkened green with shrieks of laughter. Casks of ale, sacks of flour, what looks like the carcass of a half-cooked lamb. Our mane. The half-darkened faces of the raiders, illuminated by the torches they carry, turn and look up. At the window I'm watching through. A torch sails through the air toward me. Glass shatters, the curtains billow inward. Fire rolls across the floor. Golds around me are screaming, jumping out of the torch's rolling path. I unhook the ceremonial mantle from my shoulders and lunge. The mantle smothers the flaming torch. Smoke rises from under the gilded lining of the mantle. Through the broken window comes a Cheapside accent, playful and all too close without glass to muffle it. "We know you're in there!" Annie crouches in front of me, her hair a shock of red against the black dress. "Lee?" It's as if she knows the memories that are rising up to drown me. "Use them. Get out of this alive." "We need to barricade the doors," I croak, "and get to the dragons before they separate us." The shouts and crashes below are sufficient to keep our conversation private. Annie's face flickers, understanding, and she rises. Her voice is level, barely raised, but clear. "Power, bolt and barricade the entrances to the second floor. Cor, please escort the protector to a windowless room that can be locked from the inside. Dean Orthos, is there a balcony on the second floor from which we can summon dragons?" Orthos's academic cap has slid down one ear. He points a shaking finger. "Out back, attached to the garden room." "Thank you. Everyone else, stay away from the windows. Lee, with me." I follow her out of the room, her orders echoing in my ears as I understand. Annie is placing a guard around the first protector. Because in this analogue to the riots I survived as a child, Atreus is the ruler whose people are scaling his walls in search of bread. And now it's our job to protect him. Atreus, the man who engineered Palace Day. The balcony outside is bare, summer furniture stacked in the corner under tarps. Our breath rises in steam. Goose pimples are showing on Annie's bare arms. Another crash from the floor below, followed by a shriek of laughter. My hands clench at the sound. I force them loose. Annie is looking at my hands too. "Are you fit for duty?" "I'm fine." I'm pretty sure I don't sound fine. Annie exhales through tightened lips and seems to decide not to say whatever she is thinking. She stands still for a moment, cocking her head, before shaking it. "We're too far out of range." She can't feel Ayla. And the dragons won't be able to hear our summoning whistles. I have to take her word for it. My connection to Palor has never been as strong as hers to Ayla. "The roof?" Annie looks up, her lips forming a line. Then she reaches down to thumb the straps of her heeled shoes off her feet. "Lift me." I make a stirrup with laced fingers, as I did for her with Palor hours ago, and hoist. Barefooted, she scrabbles against the slate. I climb onto the nearest stack of chairs, clench the gutter with numbing fingers, and heave. There's a precarious moment where the horizon tilts, and then Annie seizes my arm, pulling my weight against the tiles. We crawl together to the apex, and finally, from the roof of the Lyceum Club, we can see everything. The porter's lodge is on fire, its gate loose on its hinges. The doors to the Lyceum Granary have been thrown open. Figures, silhouetted in the torchlight, are racing out the doors with sacks of grain slung over their shoulders, making for the carts wheeling into the courtyard. Below us, a ring of citizens, armed with torches and garden tools, have gathered at the front steps of the club. A young man with a scraggly red beard steps out from the ring and raises his voice, thick with a Cheapside accent.
"Ladies and gentlemen of the Lyceum! The Passy are here for your granary, and we might just help ourselves to your dinner too."
Annie lifts her wristband to her lips and blows through the summoning whistle. The sound is inaudible to human ears, but below us, in the lairs, Ayla will hear it. I lift my own summoner to my mouth, and then, as I take in the scene below, I hesitate. The red-bearded man is brandishing a leg of mutton like a torch.
"These are your rations. The irons are scraping after crumbs, and your people gorge themselves on racks of lamb."
It's the same rhetoric I remember from the old protests. The protests that were dismissed. The famine that was excused or overlooked. But this time, I'm not a child misled by my father's lies. I know that what this man says is true. The irons are hungry. We were eating sausage. And Atreus deserves to burn. Annie's order cuts through my racing thoughts. "Lee, summon!" I shove my wristband to my mouth and blow into the mouthpiece. We wait. The gates to the stone stables should burst open any moment now. And as we wait, the words burst from my lips. "Annie, they've got a point." Annie starts to answer and then freezes, leaning forward, her eyes narrowing. From the base of the club come the sounds of a scuffle and the slam of a door, and a figure is dragged from the building and into the crowd, which parts for him. The figure is thrust to his knees. The red-bearded man holding him lifts his head back by the collar of his uniform, presses a butcher's cleaver to his throat, and as the light catches the figure's face, Annie inhales beside me. Power. Annie blows again frantically into her wristband. "Where are they?" She closes her eyes, presses her thumbs to them, and when she looks up at me, her pupils are dilated. She has found Ayla, is spilled over, and speaks in a voice distant with double feeling.
"They're trying to barricade the stone stables," she tells me. "Ayla and Palor are still inside."
The thought of him near, afraid, and cut off from me makes my heart clench.
"They're going to have to fire to get out."
Annie nods, rubbing at her forehead, and I know she's struggling to communicate with Ayla over a connection that is little more than a twisted cable of emotions and images. Another figure steps from the crowd to approach the kneeling power. A young woman with a green scarf masking her nose and mouth.
"Southside's daughter," Annie breathes beside me, her eyes narrowing in recognition.
"Who do we have here?"
the green-scarved girl crows.
"A guardian loose without his dragon?"
She pries Power's wristband from him. Though I have little reason to think of this as anything but Power's just deserts, who not long ago pried my own wristband from me and planned his own vigilante justice out of spite, it's impossible, watching the rioters close in, not to remember.
I decided a long time ago that no one deserves this, even if power comes close. Dora Mithridates' voice answers Southside's daughter from the second floor balcony.
The Lyceum Granary serves the neighbourhoods of Cheapside and Southside, as well as Scholars Row. If you rob it, you will only be hurting those your passy claim to want to help. Unhand that boy!
Southside's daughter lets out a peal of laughter. Am I mad for thinking that laugh sounds familiar?
Serves Southside and Cheapside. You only give them a fourth of what you're giving the Golds on Scholars Row. It's time for a reset.
The sense of her words is hammering on me like fat drops of rain. Annie, she's right. Annie rounds on me. Her people have taken a guardian hostage, and we have no reason to trust they'll do anything with that grain other than keep it for themselves. Wake up, Lee. I swallow down the protests clawing up inside. Annie presses her fingers against her forehead and exhales so hard I can hear it. From below comes a sound like an explosion, and a warm glow lights the buildings. Two Aurelians erupt from the stone stables. For a moment, they are silhouetted, silver and amber wings glinting ghost-like against the dark sky, before they settle on the apex of the roof at our sides. Another flare, and the dark shadows of two storm scourges burst forth after them. Faces have turned upward, and a hush falls over the crowd at the sight of us on the roof above them. Annie leaps to her feet beside Ayla. I reach out to steady myself with a hand at the ridge of Palor's neck. He is growling, horns flattened, and black eyes fixed on the crowd threatening below. Ayla lets out a belch of fire that streams upward in a distress beacon for the city guard and any patrolling dragon riders. Annie lifts her voice to address the crowd.
The guard will be here in minutes. Release Power Sewer Eater and back your carts away from the Lyceum Granary.
Southside's daughter's eyes crinkle into a smile above the lip of her green scarf, and I feel another flutter of recognition.
Antigone Sewer Ayla, she says. I was wondering if you'd show your face.
She nods to the red-bearded man, whose grip tightens on power. He stares up at us, slack-jawed. Annie turns to me.
Secure the granary. I'll get power.
She swings herself onto Ayla, mindless of the dress that earlier she rode side-saddle to protect, and the bare skin that will burn against the two hot scales. I reach for Palor and scramble onto his bare back, clamping my knees under his wing joints and clinging to his neck as he kicks off from the ground. He lands us in front of the granary between the carts and the Lyceum gate. The granary's doors have been smashed open. The sounds of people shouting come from within. Citizens streak in and out of the gates holding half-closed sacks of grain that spill as much as they contain as they hasten to load the wagons. But when they see Palor, they freeze. I tighten my knees on his wing joints to sit taller, summoning the orders I'm supposed to give the citizens before us. Back away from the cart. Back away from the granary. But I hesitate. And then? If they refuse, do I give the command to fire? Blanket them in dragon fire for attempting to steal grain? Grain, while we dined in comfort at the Lyceum Club. What loyalty do I really have to this regime, to its barbaric rationing practices? Palor's wings are spread, his back arched, his fangs bared. A low whining growl comes from the back of his throat as he stares the raiders down. On the other side of the courtyard, flames light the night. Antigone Sewer Ayla has fired. Another flare, violet-tinged, signals the fire of a storm scourge,
Power reunited with Ita. Screams are erupting. The crowd around the club is scattering.
They've got dragons! Get out! Get out!
More raiders are emerging from the granary and clambering onto carts, seizing the reins, weighing the odds as Palor and I block their way. Palor inhales to fire, his lungs expanding between my knees. He waits on my order. In the flare of dragon fire from behind me, of Ayla and Ita lighting the courtyard, I can make out the face of the leading driver as he stares me down. Teeth bared, exposed. Nothing but flesh on bone that so easily burns. Staring eyes and hollow cheeks. Emaciation visible even in the low light. His horses rear and charge. And rather than fire, I yank Palor aside. The carts begin to stream across the green, through the burning gate and out into the city. And then, as the last raiders scramble out of the granary, I realize what they're shouting.
Fire on the rest! Burn what we can't take!
No! I shout. But we charge too late between them. The granary and what's left of its stores is in flames. Not from dragonfire. From a torch that someone flung. Behind me, from the Lyceum Club, comes a keening, hair-raising wail.
Annie. In the space of the time it takes to land Ayla between the front doors of the Lyceum Club and the mob gathered around Power, I don't process a single conscious thought. Ayla and I operate on instinct, firing over the heads of the rioters in warning. And when Southside's daughter and her red-bearded accomplice do not back away from Power, we fire again, this time at feet. There are screams. People begin to run, some with clothing on fire. Ayla's flames are so bright that when they stop, the darkness of the night is blinding. In the confusion, a storm scourge dives into the stampeding crowd and emerges clutching Power by the back of his uniform, like a mother cat carrying a kitten by the scruff of its neck. Ita deposits Power beside me on the club steps, and Power doubles over with his palms on his knees, gasping. He rubs his throat where the cleaver traced a thin red line. The city guard is pouring in the gate, the rioters screaming and running past them into the night. And on the opposite side of the square, a fire has begun to glow. I watch the chaos numbly, trying to remember what it was like before I knew how to do this. Back when I still hesitated before using dragonfire on human beings. But I was setting Ayla on unarmed villagers in collections for weeks. Armed rioters didn't take a second thought. I lean onto my knees and dry heave.
Where is she?
Power rasps. I wipe my mouth. Southside's daughter? She disappeared in the chaos after the dragonfire. And without her scarf, she could be anyone in a black coat. Power shakes his head.
Megara, he says. Megara Roper.
It takes me a moment to remember who that is. The Gold Gazette intern. Power straightens, his hand still holding his throat.
Annie, I could have sworn I recognized Southside daughter's voice.
We stare at each other. His eyes reflect the glowing of the fires around us, the people running, the city guard shouting. Dora's guests have begun to trickle down the front steps, clutching their coats and hats.
You can't be. That's quite an accusation. That's absurd.
Though not outside the bounds of possibility. She could have ducked out when Atreus arrived. She could have been the one to tip off the Passy that tonight, with festivities in the air, the Lyceum would have a slackened guard.
She could have carried a green scarf in the pocket of that nondescript coat she was wearing. Power shrugs.
Southside's daughter flaunts a gold wristband. She's known for it.
The guests begin to trickle out of the building in little groups as the city guard secures the area, handcuffing the rioters who were captured and opening the lower rooms of the club for emergency burn treatment. The Lyceum physician has been woken and brought in to aid the wounded. My wounded. I sit on the front steps of the club, listening to the cries of pain from within, making myself listen. As if, like nails dug into my skin, I'm checking that I still feel anything. Ayla, who alighted on the roof of the stone stables once her fire was no longer needed, overlooks the commotion like an impassive, monstrous gargoyle as she gnaws a leg of mutton abandoned by the raiders. At some point, someone, I think Dora, drapes my mantle over my shoulders with a gentle pat to my hair and returns my shoes. Megara Roper is not among the guests I count emerging from the upper rooms. Lee returns from the granary white-faced. Only when I take in his expression and look past him at the fire that is growing on the far side of the courtyard do I realize what's burning. The Lyceum granary is on fire.
Someone threw a torch as they were running, Lee says.
You didn't stop them?
I couldn't, Lee says. He lifts a hand to his face.
I couldn't do it. By the light of the blaze, we can make out a scattered detritus of oats and wheat, mixed with dirt and ash, strewn across the courtyard like dirty snow. I get to my feet.
What do you mean you couldn't do it? You said you were fit for duty.
Lee spreads his hands.
Maybe I'm not fit for this kind of duty.
Atreus, one of the last guests to emerge from the upper rooms, stands feet away with his great black mantle thrown over his shoulders in conversation with the captain of the guard. But he's watching us, listening. I seize Lee by the arm and yank him into the alleyway beside the stone stables, out of earshot of the first protector. The guilt and horror that has been roiling in my stomach at my own actions shifts in an instant into fury.
You're a guardian. You don't get to choose what kind of duty you're fit for. Your duty is to do what it takes.
At the sound of Atreus's phrase, Lee flinches.
They were hungry, Annie.
There are memories in that sentence. Memories that I can hear him pleading with me to remember. But I only feel more fury at such an entreaty. He wants to bring up Albin's? Let him. I remember being hungry. And I remember bullies taking my food. Does their hunger justify stealing from a public granary or qualify them to distribute the grain to others? Lee points up at Ayla's spoils from tonight's raid.
Maybe more than us.
I can feel Ayla's simple satisfaction humming, low and visceral at the back of my own throat as she chews the fatty meat. She doesn't care that the Lyceum was serving mutton during a rationing crisis. And at the moment, I have to agree with her that isn't our biggest concern. I raise a shaking hand to point at the fire bathing the courtyard in red light.
The only thing those people have proved themselves capable of is threatening the life of one of my riders and setting a grain depot on fire.
Lee's black hair is silhouetted, a thin rim of gold from the fire behind us.
Those people, he repeats, echoing my tone. Who? Class Irons? Peasants? The poor? Annie, do you know who you sound like?
I know, from how he asks this, that he doesn't mean Atreus. Behind me, Ayla lifts her head and growls.
How dare he?
Lee takes a step backward from us both. But his face is twisted with fury too, and Palor, who has slunk down the alleyway after us, is growling. He and Ayla have tensed, glaring at each other, wings and crests lifted.
Was it easy this time? Lee demands. Firing on civilians? Did you have to think twice before doing it?
They were armed! I shout.
Ayla fires, a short jet into the sky.
Palor hisses, his crest flattening.
Lee blinks at me.
He doesn't have to point out the difference between a kitchen cleaver and a dragon, and I don't deny that it was easy. But it saved Power's life, and those of dozens of Golds who shouldn't be eating bacon but don't deserve to die for it.
My fists are curling at my sides. My eyes are stinging.
The point isn't how it feels. The point is that it had to happen, or worse things would.
Lee shakes his head. The rage that I've seen smouldering on and off since the duel blazes in his grey eyes. So much rage that I have to resist the urge to take a step backward.
I'm done choosing between evils. Not for this. This regime, Atreus, he doesn't deserve it.
I laugh aloud.
The price for your clean conscience will be people starving because a granary burned.
Lee kicks at sludge under his heel and looks away, and Palor whimpers.
Am I interrupting a lover's quarrel?
I spin on my heel. Power is behind us, looking utterly delighted.
What do you want?
I was just wondering, Power says, if you'd found Megara Roper yet.
No, I snap, too furious at the interruption to give a damn about Roper or Power's conspiracy theory.
And what about Kor?
Power asks. I open my mouth to snap again, when I realize I haven't. I haven't seen Kor since the fire started. Not since Southside's daughter disappeared.
Kor, who openly hates the rationing program, and his childhood friend, who hasn't been spotted since the riot began, are gone. Along with a dragon.
Suddenly, Power's theory feels a lot more alarming and a lot less absurd. I turn back to Lee, but he's already walking away.
Lee. Palor and I are aloft over the city in minutes. Moonlight shimmers through the low clouds and casts the city in a pale glow. The twisting river Fur, the latticed hills of the Janiculum, Pytho's Keep rising in shadow. From on high, the blaze that the city guard struggles to put out in the Lyceum is dwarfed to the size of a hearth fire. With Palor still unsaddled, the legs of my ceremonial uniform burning on his hot scales, and nothing keeping me from falling but my own clamped knees, it occurs to me that Palor and I are violating every rule of basic flight safety training. I don't care. My heart is hammering, Annie's fury echoing in my ears. Those people. How could this be how she sees it? Firing on commoners to protect Atreus and his coterie. Hours ago, I was speechless with delight at the sight of Annie on Palor's back, and now all I want to do is shake her. How can someone be so beautiful, so brilliant, and so wrong? Maybe I shouldn't have let the granary burn. Maybe the Passy were too violent, needlessly violent, for their ends. But that didn't stop their words from being true. Callipolis deserves better than what Atreus and his hypocritical regime are giving it. And I'm done defending a man who killed my family and now fails his city the same way they did. I scan the shadowed rooftops with narrowed eyes and almost don't believe when I see it, the flutter of black like a bat's wings against the thatched roofs of Highmarket, slipping out of sight. My knees tighten under Palor's wings as we dive. We find them in the sunken pit of a half-built bunker, fenced off to the public, manned by class irons during the day, but deserted at night. A dragon, its rider, and a young woman. The storm scourge is pitch black in the moonlight. A green scarf encircles the woman's neck. Palor lands opposite them, and I confirm. She's exactly who I think she is. "This," Southside's daughter is telling Kor, "is not the way I was expecting our friendship to rekindle, I'll admit." They turn at the sound of my boots crunching on gravel. Kor takes a step forward as if to stand between the girl and my dragon. "Lee?" "Kor?" For a moment it seems neither of us knows what happens next. And then I turn to Megara Roper. "You make a good speech." Her teeth flash white in the darkness. "So do you, Lee Sir Palor."
11. The Kraken's Arms. Griff. "My punishment forfeit if I bring a Kallipolan rider down today." The luck of the damned is a strange, fierce kind of luck. Fog rolls in layers over a darkening sky as we launch to flush the scouts. When we burst through the last layer, the sun is still setting above. Stars to the east, gold to the west. Here and there around us, the tops of karst pillars poke from the stratus like islands of rock. The rest of the riders are breaking cloud cover around us. Sparker and I are at Dilo Sir Jafira's wing for the first time since Julia's passing. And I can't help thinking, this is how it should be. Not a foreign rider is in sight, but my hopes are up. I know what we're looking for, and I've got a pending punishment riding on it. I'll find them. "What the hell were you thinking?" Dilo shouts. "You shouldn't have confessed." With the wind masking our voices, it's easy to have a private conversation. "Like I said, no. Who are you covering for? Aga? Your grandfather?" Dilo's neck is twisted, his face hidden by his helmet as he looks at me. I look back at him and for a half second experience anger matching that in his voice. "If it bothers you so much, why didn't you speak up?" But that's not fair, because what choice did he have? I dig my heel into Sparker's side and announce, "I've got a lucky feeling about Kraken." Kraken is the karst I saw those riders emerge from 2 days ago. I know what the others don't, that whoever's been sighted has been camping out near us for days. Dilo slumps, exasperated. "Why?" I put on my best Norish brogue and wave an arm. "Call it my mystical Norsian connection to the karst." "Your clan karst is Nag," Dilo shouts. But when I set off for the Kraken's Arms, he follows, cursing. I can't hear most of it, but I make out "Death Wish" and "Stubborn as a Storm Scourge." I pat Sparker's flank affectionately at the remark and hug my pike tighter to my side. "Aren't we?" Mystical connections aside, I do have a Norsian's knowledge of the karsts, and I've had 3 days to imagine which crevices in Kraken I'd hide in if I were spying on new Pythos. As we sweep back into the gloom of the fog, I lead Dilo Sir Jafira towards the pillars I have in mind. We loop round my own clan's karst, the Nag, with her gracefully curved neck and all her crooked fissures, circle the turret with his densely wooded crown, and approach the Kraken with all her arms, thin arches of stone. Kraken's proved one of the least fruitful mines, and most of its floating docks are long abandoned, the mine shafts slowly eroding into tidal caves. Puffins nest on the ancient standing stones of Kraken Shrine atop the arch of her tallest arm. We latch onto the wall of the central arm and scuttle the dragons around its base like great crabs, talons clinging to crevices. When we round the sharpest slab, the Kraken's eroding mine entrance comes into view. Dragon scales glint in the darkness of the mine's entrance. For a half second, I think we might catch them unawares and corner them in their hideaway. But then a flare of dragonfire lights from the cave, and the two skyfish burst forth. The Kallipolin scouts. Jaffeera and Sparker kick off from the karst to split and tail. But the skyfish that Sparker's following puts us behind her quickly, no match for her speed, as her rider's golden braid streams out from under her helmet. She weaves into the Kraken's arms, and soon it's all I can do to keep sight of her as we wind in and out of the stone pillars. On the far side of the arms, Delos or Jaffeera have better luck, gaining on their target, forcing the little skyfish to slow as they fire. The target's weave is ridiculously, absurdly regular, and Dilo begins to land hits. Once, twice, I can hear the rider grunting with pain. Ahead of me, the girl's helmet turns to the sound, and then her skyfish swerves, sacrificing their lead on us to cross the distance and close on Jaffeera. I complete the triangle, gaining. She fires, a full heat hit on Dilo that makes Jaffeera spiral off course, freeing her wing rider from Dilo's advance, and then I intercept. The golden-haired rider wheels her skyfish round with startling speed. Suddenly we're in range of their dragonfire. I grip the reins, brace for the blast, preparing to barrel through it. And instead of firing, the rider says something. Like she's speaking to me. But that doesn't make sense. I take the opening and charge, ramming my pike into her side while Sparker's fangs sink into her leg and his talons into her skyfish's wing. I pierce armor. Her scream rends the fog. We slam as one against a pillar and begin to slide down it. And then I realize what I heard her just say. Dragon tongue. Wait. Wait for what? What could she possibly be expecting? That we'd stop and chat mid-ambush? But I don't have time to figure out what she wants. I don't have the luxury of waiting. Rhodes' punishment, forfeit. Loyalty to prove. A family to protect. Sparker and I tighten our hold. We're scraping down the side of the karst, locked together, toward the crashing waves below as the dragon and rider both shriek and struggle. In the dusk light, distance is hard to measure, the arms mere silhouettes spinning around us. Flashes of light emit from Delos or Jaffeera as they fire on the other skyfish. I have a moment of giddy satisfaction. We'll bring them both down. We've got them both. And then light, like an explosion, fills the fog and illuminates the arms. The second skyfish has fired full heat, within Delos or Jaffeera's range, blasting them back. Dilo! I hear myself shouting. The second skyfish hurtles towards us, its fire blistering as it searches for me and Sparker. We let go of the female rider, and a boy's voice calls in panicked Kalish through the fog. She answers him, her skyfish kicking away from the karst. They're rising, seeking the fog, the female rider's dragon struggling to beat the air with wings Sparker shredded. And for a moment, I grip the saddle with both knees, frozen as I calculate. Her skyfish slowed by injury. Could my storm scourge catch her? But Sparker is panting, tired, and Delos or Jaffeera is nowhere in sight. Dilo! I shout again. The Kallipolin riders are about to be lost in fog. My last chance of proving loyalty and appeasing Rhodes' rage. But at a sound from below, I know I let them go. Groaning. And then my name. Griff! Dilo. In pain. I turn my back on the vanishing Kallipolins and rein Sparker down to the sound of his voice.
12. The War That Matters. Annie. It's dawn by the time Power and I finish escorting the harrowed Janiculum residents home from the Lyceum. Most of the land birds have already left Gallipolis for the winter, but a few lonely gull cries break with the dawn as we bid the last golds goodnight
and the dragons have begun to yawn. We don't talk about the fact that Lee and Kor have vanished along with Megara Roper. I think, if Power mentions it again, the headache that has begun to pound between my eyes will burst. As we kick off from the lower foothills of the Janiculum to ride a low morning breeze back to the palace, Power lifts an arm.
Annie.
I told you I don't want to hear it.
No. Look.
He points. Two dragons approaching on the northern horizon, barely distinguishable from the grey that precedes dawn. Two skyfish. Krissa and Duck are back. I dismount Ayla in the courtyard off the palace infirmary where they descend. Phaedra has landed on her side, a wing angled into the air. A keeper kneels beside her, examining her while she snorts ash onto the flagstones, and another keeper holds her still. The membrane of her wing is shredded. I can see the dawn light through the gashes. Duck stands beside his skyfish, Surtur, in his armor and flame suit, helmet flung to the ground at his feet. I run to him, wrap my arms around him, and inhale.
You're all right.
I'm all right.
Duck's face is dark with ash, and though the smell of dragon fire lingers, there are no signs of serious burns. The wind in the courtyard stirs, and two more dragons alight in it, a storm scourge and a white Aurelian. Kor and Lee. Drawn by the sight of the returning two skyfish as I was, back from wherever they disappeared to. They dismount and approach us at a run. Kor seizes Duck after me.
Dorian!
I'm fine, Duck says, as Kor clasps his arms around him.
Kor and Lee are both still in ceremonial uniform. I feel the fury I've been suppressing rise again at the sight of their decorations. It's been hours. Neither has been seen since the Lyceum was sacked, and here they arrive on Dragonback?
Where have you two been?
Kor answers without meeting my eyes.
We were looking for the stolen carts.
Really? Did Southside's daughter help you find them? Kor stiffens. He lifts his hands, like he might to handle an overbearing mother.
Look, why don't you just calm down?
Kor, says Lee.